listen on speaker, and I'm sure it'll be just as powerful and wonderful as every other one that we've had. So I'd like to welcome Gayla from Nashville, and I think I'm moving to Nashville. There's a lot of recovery there.
Hi, everybody. My name's Gayla. I'm a grateful Essanon, and I'm from the suburbs of Nashville, Tennessee. And it's an honor to be here. I have not been in Essanon very long. It's just over 2.5 years, 3 years since I discovered that I qualified. And the stories that we've heard from the Essanons from this podium so far this weekend have been extremely powerful and inspired a tremendous amount of hope for what can happen after years of recovery. My story is going to be a little bit different. I'm 3 years out, 2.5 years working the steps. So what you're going to hear about from me today is you're going to hear about all the hope and all the joy, but you're going to hear a little bit more about what happens when we trudge the journey, what happens between years 1 and 3. What happens between years 3 and 25? Well, I'll discover that at some other point. But so my story is going to be a little bit closer in. This is about the hope that can be extracted from this situation that entered my life closer in. So I'm going to start by giving you a brief overview of my qualifiers, and there are many. And then I'm going to talk about the phases of my recovery, what life was like for me 6 months out, a year out, 18 months out, 2 years out. And then I'm going to talk a lot more. I'm going to spend a lot more time talking about what Essanon has given me in the way of a solution. I'll start by saying that my first qualifiers, and that's plural, were in my family of origin. There was a lot of addiction going on. Both of my parents were adult children of alcoholics. One or both may have been sexually abused. Both used food and work addictively. One or both, neither had the tools to connect emotionally with me or my siblings. So all of us kids developed our own addictions. We all ate addictively. Food, sex, and work became our addictions, but not necessarily developed in that order. My father had a porn habit that he tried to hide. But as many of you know, it's virtually impossible to hide pornography from kids. Especially bored kids in the 70s. That was before the advent of video and other moving forms of porn. Once the neighbor kids found their dad's stash, all of us other kids in the neighborhood had to figure out where our own dad's stashes were. And we all found them. I remember, as I looked at the stash, wondering if my mom knew about this. And I wonder how she felt about my dad looking at these pictures of women. And I wondered if she felt betrayed or if she felt sad. Well, in my first marriage, I would find out. which brings me to my second qualifier, my second husband. He was an alcoholic with a hidden porn habit. But when I look back, actually, the habit wasn't all that hidden. The 8-foot stack of porn next to the front door on the first date should have been my first clue. But like so many women 25 to 30 years ago, I figured that was just what men did. Men just did that, and the women just pretended not to notice. But despite my outward acceptance of this, I did feel tremendous shame and rejection. You know, there was no way I was ever going to look like that. Nobody with an airbrush was going to follow me around and, you know, smooth out the whatever, or, and you know, just it wasn't going to happen. there was just no way that I could compete with a fantasy, and I knew that intuitively, even though I internalized the shame because of that. But even more, I knew that a fantasy would never ask him to take out the trash. A fantasy would never ask him to clean up the baby vomit. A fantasy would never ask to have her needs met, and I couldn't compete with that. So eventually that marriage ended, which brings me to my third qualifier, which is my current husband. Now, when we met, it seems like that we would have been a better match, but I knew going into that relationship that I would have to hide my real self from him. And since we both worked at the same company, our primary connection was work. Now, I never saw him use porn, which was a great relief after the experience in my first marriage. But there wasn't any emotional intimacy. And as our careers rose together, we both slid deeper into workaholism. And the amount of time that we actually spent together fell. Eventually, we were leading parallel lives. So outside of my marriage, I was this vibrant, successful person, a successful career. But inside my marriage, I was silent. I tiptoed around my husband, trying not to set off that anger that always seemed to be simmering below the surface. I told myself that by being silent, I was just accepting him for who he was. I told myself that I shouldn't expect my husband to be interested in me, that in long-term marriages, that was just too much to ask. I told myself that I was going to stay no matter what, because I didn't want to be a two-time loser. I'd been divorced once, didn't want to be divorced again. But despite my outward acceptance, what I was telling myself, inside I was seething, absolutely seething with disappointment and resentment. So by 2007, after about 13 years of marriage, it was very clear that something was wrong. What had long been benign emotional neglect in my marriage had become malignant emotional neglect. In the year before what I call D-Day, which is the day that I discovered what was really going on, I experienced what I now know many of us Essenons go through. The discovery of inappropriate behavior followed by gaslighting, blame shifting, justifications, and the rewriting of marital history. I think many of us have been there. I heard, "I love you, but I'm not in love with you." I heard, "The spark is gone." Isn't there a song, "The thrill is gone"? Well, I suppose. I didn't hear that, but I heard something like that. So as this benign emotional neglect morphed into something far more toxic, I realized that all those years of holding back, all those years of being silent, all those years of walking on eggshells, of absorbing bad moods, and of being always the one to adapt, the emotional sponge in the relationship, all of that effort had not prevented this. I had spent most of my marriage in an emotional foxhole, thinking that if I didn't ask for anything, if I didn't have any needs, didn't make any demands, if I was always accommodating, that I would be rewarded with loyalty, at least, and kindness, at best. But I was wrong. So as the emotional abuse continued, my love for him evaporated. So D-Day, the day that I discovered what was really going on, that happened on June 17th, 2008. I had already filed for divorce at that point, and we were actually in our waiting period. I was divorcing my husband because I didn't want to be married to an emotionally abusive man anymore. I didn't know about the sexual acting out, but I had my suspicions. But I didn't care enough about the relationship to even do any investigation. I just wanted out. So after 2 weeks after he moved out, he called and said that he'd been fired from his job. And it was later in that day that he told me that he'd been leading a double life with multiple affair partners during the previous 6.5 years, which was half of our marriage at the time. Now, mind you, this disclosure, unlike many of your disclosures out there, was not done in a therapeutic setting. Unless you consider sitting in a small boat in the middle of a flood control lake in Tennessee to be a therapeutic setting. I couldn't get away. There was nowhere for me to go. I could have swum to shore, but, you know. Yeah. So at this point, I had been in a different recovery program for about 19 years, and I'd heard a lot of fourth and fifth steps, so I knew what I was dealing with. I was able to set boundaries for my safety. But the inner gala, the feeling gala, the gala that had been neglected, denied, and ignored for all of those years slid into a deep, dark hole. But the sponsor gala, the gala who had been in recovery herself, I knew what it was like to want to stop something and to stay stopped, but to absolutely be unable to stop and stay stopped. I knew what that was like. But somehow, my husband's acting out was way worse. It just seemed way worse. It seemed like way more of a personal affront to me than eating too much ice cream would have been to him. You know, I never told the ice cream that I loved it. Well, at least not openly. I never promised the ice cream that I would divorce it and run off with another flavor or something. But intuitively, I knew that the lies that I had told myself to get more ice cream and the lies that I had told others so I could be alone to eat the ice cream were similar. I knew that here. But, you know, even in the haze of that terrible day, I could see the parallels between his acting out and my own, but it was just too much for me to process at the time. So I didn't process it then. But I did know enough not to make any decisions about the future of the relationship that day. I knew that I was not going to be willing to stay married to an active alcoholic or an active addict or someone whose behavior threatened by physical safety. So I stopped the divorce and decided to wait to see what would happen. And the months that followed were torture, absolute torture, as I learned more of the details about my husband's acting out. At 6 months out, I was still numb, yet it was impossible to think about anything else. I was attempting to piece together my past. Who was this man? Had he told me everything? Was there more? Of course there was more. There had to be more. I cycled in between fits of rage and crushing sadness. And now, I had never been a rager before. In fact, my husband had never seen me mad. But I was a rager now. But my rage, the extent of my rage, was throwing socks at my husband and screaming. No, I didn't. There are some things that I didn't do. It didn't involve any firearms, so I guess we're fortunate there. But everything was a trigger. Everything was a trigger during this period. Road signs to the city where my husband worked when he was acting out. Getting gas for the car on the interstate on the road that, you know, to one of the affair partner's cities. The name of a fast food chain was a trigger. My husband's SUV was a trigger. Any mention of his previous employer was a trigger. Because pictures and memories from my past now all had new meaning. It was like they were a video that had to be re-rendered to integrate all of this new information. And I have to say that at times my husband's very presence was a trigger. And the biggest trigger of all during this period was his inability, seemingly, to demonstrate compassion or empathy for me during this period of time. And so that made the triggers worse. That meant more socks got thrown. Anyways, by the six-month point after disclosure, I could see that the tools in my own 12-step toolbox, the tools that I'd picked up during my 19 years of recovery, were not adequate to deal with this. As it's been said before, the credits don't transfer, and it's very true. So that's when I came to SNON, and I got a sponsor and started working the steps. So at the one-year mark, this is 1 year after disclosure, 6 months into SNON, my frozen emotions are starting to thaw. Though I was working the steps with a sponsor, I was mired in what I now know is situational depression. And I was tortured with a should I stay or should I go question. Maybe some of you in this room can relate to that. I was grieving. I was cycling through all the stages of grief at once. It's not linear at all. It's iterative, circular. I would make commitments and not want to keep them. I had all the signs of depression. I lost interest in my hobbies. I wanted to isolate. I'm a business owner. Going out and networking and all the small talk required to make connections, I had no interest in any of that. But I was working my steps at this point and really starting to get some insight into how my past had groomed me to be the perfect partner for emotionally detached addicts. I was still triggering on a fairly regular basis at that time, and my sponsor was always encouraging me to focus on the present, trying to bring me back to the present. But I was very resistant because in my head, I didn't know what my past really was. That re-rendering process took some time. But I think the worst part during that time was my inability to contain the resentment. I would have a few good days in a row, but eventually the resentment would build and explode, ignited by a trigger that would start that downward spiral of thinking that many of you may be familiar with. The pressure would reach a point where I would go off on my husband. And I must say that at this point, he's in recovery. So the first time I'm in the middle of a trigger and I hear the words, "Maybe you should call your sponsor." You know, for those of you listening on CD, you just can't, you know, the look on the face here says it all. But that, I realized that there was something really, it enraged me. That's the kind of thing that I'm supposed to say to people. I'm not supposed to have that said to me. So, but he was right. He was right. So at 18 months out, the reality of all of this was really starting to sink in. There was no hiding from the fact that this had happened. It was now an irrevocable part of my past. But now, I didn't want a marriage that had this kind of crap in its history. It was tainted. And I also, at this point in my recovery, became aware of a very deep self-hatred. I despised myself for staying with someone who could do this to me. I have pages and pages in my journals devoted to the question, what does it say about me if I stay with someone who could treat me with such disregard? Speaking of disregard, by the 2-year mark, my step work was revealing that my husband's disregard for me was nothing compared to the disregard that I had shown myself, not just in this marriage, but in my relationships with others, and most importantly, in my relationship with myself. I was getting a good look at my own deception, the lies that I had to tell myself in order to stay in relationships with, and I'll quote from the Asanon Problem, people who could not or would not love and support me in a healthy way. It was becoming very clear that I had abandoned myself in every way. This isn't something my husband had done to me. This was something that I had done to myself. Even though I wasn't to steps 8 and 9 yet, I found myself wondering if the only way I could ever make sufficient amends to myself for such blatant self-disregard was to leave the marriage. That's what I was thinking about then. So at 2.5 years out, I was starting to feel more like my normal self. My enthusiasm for my work and my hobbies was coming back. I was triggering on occasion and getting very tired of it. I hated how I felt afterwards. I hated how I felt about myself afterwards. It was almost like being hungover from a drunk. Now, I know what that feels like. And the hangover after an emotional trigger was very similar. But at this point now, my obsession shifted. I became obsessed with the notion of justice. I kept thinking that the only way I could ever have justice was to deny my now 2 years sober husband the thing he wanted most, which was to build a new and better marriage. And I'll talk more about that in a moment. So today, at just over 3 years out, I have way, way more good days than bad days. I don't think about leaving much at all. I was told by many people in this room that this takes time. There's no substitute for time. And time is actually a 4-letter word now in my book. But it's given me distance and perspective from this gut-wrenching event. And I am seeing that I have the ability to integrate this into my life without sacrificing my self-respect, because it's all about perspective. The Asanon program is about a shift in perspective. Let's take the should I stay or should I go question. I'm pretty sure that some people in this room have asked that question at least once or twice. So until recently, there wasn't a day that would go by that I didn't think about the possibility of leaving. Today, I don't think about it very much because this program has helped me see the problem from a different perspective. The keys tell us that we will get that if we work this program. So for me, leaving once meant justice. It seemed like the only logical way to make amends to myself for abandoning myself in this relationship. Leaving seemed like the only way to preserve what little shred of self-respect I had. Leaving would free me to have an affair with myself. And it would give me the chance to really get to know myself after all those years of subtle but profound self-neglect. Actually, I saw leaving as the only sufficient punishment for my husband's deception. Denying my husband the thing he wanted most, which was now to stay together, it seemed fair to me. It seemed like the scales of justice would be leveled. But would they be leveled? The reality is, there are no guarantees. Leaving may have given me vindication, but it wouldn't guarantee that the next guy wouldn't be leading a double life that I would discover 10 years into the marriage. Leaving would also do something else, something far more profound. It would deny me the opportunity to experience the fruit of answered prayer. For many years before D-Day, I prayed that my husband, who was clearly unhappy, would find peace, recovery, and a closer relationship with a higher power of his understanding. I prayed that God would give him all the good things that I wanted for myself. For years, I dedicated the fruits and benefits of my spiritual practice to his well-being, and for years, it didn't seem like it was working. But then, on the worst day of my life, my prayers began to be answered. My husband found recovery, and as he accumulated weeks and months and eventually years of sobriety, I realized that I was now living with an answered prayer. I mean, how many of us get to do that? I was waking up in the morning next to an answered prayer. I was being served breakfast in bed by an answered prayer. I was being asked to build a brand new marriage with an answered prayer. But my pride had other ideas. My pride was telling me to divorce this answered prayer so I could have some justice. My pride told me that I needed to live on my own for as long as the acting out had occurred. And when that time was up, my answered prayer could get in line and fill out an application to be in my life again. My pride told me that my answered prayer hadn't been punished enough. I don't know, maybe some of you can relate to this. So I finally got what I wanted. I got a sober and recovering husband to join me on the path to the recovery. That's what I'd always prayed for. But I didn't understand why it had to happen this way. You know, why sex addiction? This is so devastating and it's so personal. So it's taken supernatural intervention to shift my perspective on all of this. And one of the biggest things that I learned as I worked the steps and worked on my recovery was that there's a spiritual reason for all of this. I needed to understand why. What's the spiritual why? So today I believe that there was a reason for this to happen, a larger spiritual reason. I believe that I was supposed to learn a spiritual lesson that I couldn't learn any other way. I may have had the opportunity to learn this lesson before, but I wasn't awake enough to get it. So my higher power sent the five-alarm fire version to wake me up, and it worked. And for me, I think that this particular lesson is drawn from the learning through opposites curriculum. For someone like me who grew up in a family where there was no forgiveness, no atonement, no reconciliation, no second chances, there's no better teaching tool than to have somebody do something unforgivable who then seeks forgiveness. You see, in my family, you cut off people who did you wrong. You hold grudges. Emotional and physical exile is the only appropriate response for an offense of this magnitude. So nobody seeks forgiveness because nobody admits they did anything wrong. But here I am now confronted with a situation where a terrible wrong has been done, forgiveness is being sought. What do I do with that? I have no tools. So this is why I need a program. And the Essanon program has taught me a lot of things. It's given me a new way to look at the situation, a spiritual way. It's like I'm looking at the situation from ground zero, and now, because of this program, I can look at it from 30,000 feet. And you know when you're in an airplane, you can see a whole lot more than you can see when you're on the ground. But the most important thing that Essanon has taught me is the right questions to ask. The right question is not, how could my husband do this to me, or how can I make sure he stops acting out, or even how can I stay safe in a relationship with a sex addict. The right question, the central question in my recovery is this: what is it about me that would make me think it was ever okay to be in relationships with people who don't love and support me in a healthy way? That's the question. So the answer to that question came slowly as I worked the steps with my sponsor, read conference-approved literature, went to conventions, heard stories just like this, and heard others tell my story in meetings. I came to see that growing up in my family of origin conditioned me to accept neglect and mistake disinterest for love. I was reminded frequently that I was supposed to be a boy when I was growing up, and that boys were somehow more valuable. Growing up in this family led me to draw certain conclusions about myself, my worth, and my value. We talk about some of these conclusions when we read the Essanon problem. These conclusions eventually coalesced into a belief system that helped me survive an emotionally barren childhood, but made intimacy in relationships virtually impossible. And here are just a few of those beliefs if you want a little peek inside the head here. I learned that since my parents didn't have time for me or any interest in knowing me, that I must not be worth knowing or spending any time with. I believe that asking for help, expressing emotions, or asking to be soothed or comforted would lead to punishment. I couldn't share my vulnerability with anyone because it would be used against me. I believed that as a girl, I was somehow a second-class citizen. Therefore, I had to do whatever possible to deny my femaleness and attempt to be an honorary boy, which, by the way, does not work. I believe that since no one cared, it was up to me to find comfort wherever I could get it. And I've looked for it in a lot of places. I looked for it at the bottom of a half gallon of ice cream, in the sale racks at the department store, and in the size of my W-2. And if I couldn't find comfort, distraction would do. And there's nothing like the intensity of a relationship with a sexaholic to be a convenient distraction. I believed that it was not enough to just be me. I had to earn love by performing well, by being super helpful, or by not having any needs, and by not rocking the boat. And worst of all, I believed that everybody else was my higher power. The approval of others, from true authority figures in my life down to the checkout clerk, they were all my higher power. Their opinion mattered so much. So these core beliefs shaped me into a person who was focused on compliance. Just tell me what you want from me and I'll deliver it, all the while secretly resenting you for making the demand and resenting myself for abandoning myself in order to meet it. Essanon has changed the game. It's helped reprogram me at the code level. Here are some of the things that I've learned. I've learned how to rely on a higher power, a real higher power who's there for me, not a higher power in the form of parental approval or my husband's approval or following a really strict food plan, but a higher power that loves me the way I always wished my parents would. My higher power gently reminds me that everything that happens is an opportunity for spiritual growth, that is, if I'm awake enough to get it. I have learned that the only way I will get the data I need in order to know if relationships are healthy for me is to be myself at full volume. Because remember, for years I was silent in my relationships. If I dial back my galeness or tiptoe around in order to avoid conflict means I'm not getting the information I need to know if I should stay in this relationship. I've learned to speak my truth. It now takes me less time to know what that truth actually is. I withhold less and ask for what I need. The response of others to the expression of my needs is not a measure of my worth. It's just data. Just data. I've learned that to let relationships find their own level. Because I felt so unworthy, I would do all the work in a relationship. I'd do all the initiating, make all the plans, because I was afraid that if I didn't do it, the other person wouldn't value me enough to do it. This was all hidden from my awareness, and it came out as a result of step work and therapy. I've learned that my tendency, my default, is to look to people, places, things, and behaviors to meet needs that they were never designed to meet. I tried to fill that God-shaped hole in me with just about everything but God. Today, I can choose differently. I've learned to challenge my uninvestigated beliefs and thoughts. I now view my desires about the way I'm treated in a relationship as preferences, because I can't demand anything from another person. I can't demand fidelity. I can't demand recovery. A demand like, my husband should not be a sex addict, becomes, my husband may have this disease, but I have a higher power who's got my back. And as long as I stay connected, I will be okay, and I'll know what to do to be able to take care of myself, no matter what he does, no matter what anyone does. I'm learning to look at the reasons that I do things. I have a lot of skills, and I am very good at a lot of things. And the program has taught me to look at my motivation. If I'm doing something to earn love or approval, I'm setting myself up for resentment. I'm much better today at surrendering to my higher power the resentment that once consumed every waking moment. That is not an exaggeration. Resentment at the essays in my life for what they did to me, and resentment at myself for feeling duped and deceived and for not leaving the relationship sooner. I've learned that if I'm feeling resentment, I'm not focusing on myself in a healthy way. I used to think that focusing on myself meant thinking about my problems all the time. That's not really what it means. And then I thought that focusing on myself meant pretending my problems didn't exist. So focusing on myself does not equal denial. Just want to make that clear. And what I did in those years by pretending or by not thinking about my problems really meant distracting myself from my problems by focusing on gratitude. It's possible to use some of the tools of this program as a form of delusion, and I did that. Today, I know that focusing on myself means something different. It means looking at myself and at life in a completely different way. Thanks to this program and the miracle it has brought about in my perspective, I now have the ability to take a resentment and subject it to a process that returns my focus to the only thing that I have any control over, and that's myself, the way I think, and how I respond. Now, I've learned that everything in this program is suggested, just as it's suggested that if you're going to jump out of an airplane, you pack a parachute. There are no mandates in this program, but I was told by sponsors in the past that if you want what I have, you'll do what I do. And the way I interpret that today is the experience, strength, and hope that I have to offer a sponsee is merely a suggestion. It's an example of something that worked or didn't work, whatever the case may be. I've learned that what happens to me is not nearly as important as the story I tell myself about what happened to me. For years, I told myself a victim story, and I didn't even realize that I was doing it. Today, I want my story to be a story of victory, a story of a woman who showed great courage in the face of adversity, and with the help of a higher power and this program, found a way to love with her eyes wide open, to open her heart despite the risks, knowing that no matter what happened, she will be okay. That's the story I want. And thanks to this program, I am slowly, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, developing the spiritual stamina required to spend more and more time viewing my life and what happens to me from this higher perspective. My goal is to have peace and serenity that is not contingent upon anyone else's behavior. I don't do this perfectly, but I'm getting better, and God has transformed what was once a mess into a message. Yeah. So, that is a good ending. That is a good ending. I'm eternally grateful. This is the thank you part. I'm eternally grateful to all of you who are here today, especially to those of you whose service made it possible for me to have a meeting to go to, a meeting to land in. And I'm grateful for all of you who are trudging this road to happy destiny with me. And I can't do it without you. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, Gayla, keep coming back. What a great line, mess. Gayla talked about the passage of time, and how much better can you do than mess and mess age? It was great. I'm David Maynard. I'm a sexaholic.
Hi, David.
And Kathleen, and I just told her we had to come up and say goodbye. So I wasn't any more ready than she isn't. This has been a wonderful conference. Many people have also already had to leave, and I know that. And at the same time, throughout the entire process of developing this conference and throughout the entire weekend, it has just been really clear that the energy that got going with the issue of Time magazine in 1974, which I still have in my files, has continued to this day, some now 35, 36 years later, to grow and to benefit and to reach out and touch people who had no idea they needed to be touched, much less that there was a solution for the problems and the pain that they had found themselves in. On behalf of all those people yet to come, I want to thank you for having come here for this event. I want to thank the committee, my co-chair, Kathleen, and all of the people who were standing and working. I especially want to thank our hotel liaison, Suzanne, who has worked probably harder than any of us individually. And the hotel hates to see her coming because they always have to reduce their prices. And by the way, they told me that more than once, more than one person. And then there will be more conferences yet to come. And yet each time we do get a chance, I was talking with one of my sponsors this morning, each time we get to come, it's a miracle. And I hope that we all, excuse me, I hope we all take that miracle with us and go home and not only spread it, but then spread it when we come back together again. That's my goodbye. And oh, I'm fine. I just cry a lot. And I'll give Kathleen a minute, and then we'll go on with our final essay speaker.
Hi, my name is Kathleen, a grateful recovering Essanon. Oh, gosh, what a thrill this has been. And I'm just so delighted to, you know, people keep saying, aren't you glad it's over? You know, I got to tell you, I'm having a great time. And to me, what has been most just gratifying is to see the individuals in our program grow. I've seen amazing changes and a lot of stuff shifting under the surface and our opportunities to just continue to heal and grow and give is just, I can't wait to see what's going to happen next. So I'm very grateful to all of you for coming so that we had an opportunity to do the work that we did, honestly. So, you know, until we meet again, till we see one another, you know, I'll really hold this experience in my heart, and I'm very grateful that for this opportunity. Thanks.
My name is Gavin. I'm a grateful sexaholic. Just real quick as an essay, I just want to thank all the Essanons. I get so much out of your shares. Your experience, strength, and hope absolutely amazes me, and I tend to put you on a pedestal, and I got to watch you, so I'm going to start crying really quick. So thank you so much. It's just been very amazing to be here. And our next speaker is Robert M. from Atlanta.
Good morning. My name is Robert, and I am a sexaholic. I'm powerless over lust, and my sobriety date is January 3rd, 1991. My home group is the Surrendered Group in Norcross, Georgia. I'd like to thank Will and the committee for inviting me to speak this morning. It's always an honor and a privilege. I'd like to start with a prayer. And I'm also a recovering alcoholic, and in my home group in when I lived in Charleston, South Carolina, one night we were talking about the 11th step, and everybody was talking about their method of prayer and meditation. And there was one member of the group, a guy by the name of Shoopy, and Shoopy had been sober a long time, but had also drank for a long time. And he had brain damage, you know, wet brain from his years of abusing alcohol, and Shoopy wasn't the brightest bulb in the room, but God, he had just had this rock solid program, and as we're going around the room talking, Shoopy, when it came time for Shoopy to speak, Shoopy said, "Yeah, I pray every day. I get out of bed and I get on my knees and I say, God, don't let me be stupid today." I love that prayer. In fact, I started this morning like that. As a child, I was sexually molested. I grew up in a household that had a violent and abusive parent, alcoholic, sex addict, and used to get beat a lot. And today I understand that as a child that grows up in an environment like that and experiences those things, pretty much what you can look forward to is a life of alcoholism, drug addiction, and sexual dysfunction. And I think a lot of the reason why I drank and used the way that I did was my inability to deal with my S stuff. I like to say that the Lord got me sober, and that was Judge Lord in El Cajon, California. I started showing up in the California correctional system, and this guy, Judge Lord, told me that I was a homicide looking for a place to happen, and it wasn't going to happen in San Diego County, that I was going to do some time, and he got my attention. And as a condition, eventually as a condition of release, I agreed to go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I think it was like 9 months. I had to go to 2 a week. But my life changed. At my first meeting, it was a speaker's meeting. And it was at the War Memorial Building in Balboa Park. And, I mean, there were 500 people in this room. And this guy told his story. And what he said was that, you know, he wasn't crazy. He was sick. And he did a lot of the same things that I had done. And he said that his body had an allergy that was coupled with a mental obsession. And that if we didn't drink, went to meetings, got a sponsor, worked the steps, life would get better. And if we didn't, and we were an alcoholic of his type, life would get worse. Well, I started going to meetings and got sober. But with my self-will and my great intellect, I realized that, you know, I could do this myself and make sense of the 12 steps and 12 traditions by myself. And I got to decide just by myself just what I would think and how I would act. And the end result was 5 years in relapse, 3 years in relapse, 1 year in relapse, 3 years yet again, clean and sober, sitting naked on my bedroom floor with a gun in my mouth. You know, I tried living life drinking and using, and that didn't work. And I tried life living sober, and that was worse. And if there is a hell on earth, that's got to be it. Well, I pointed out to my sponsor, that night my life changed. Now, I didn't pull the trigger, but I lost my life that night. And I surrendered to God in a way that I had never done that before. And I became willing. And I was given the gift of desperation. And I got desperate enough to ask this guy to be my sponsor. And he didn't say yes. What he said was, "Come on over to the house and we'll talk about it." And I went over to his house and I kind of told him what was going on. And I was a self-made man. And he said, "Robert, you used unskilled labor." You know, I have a lot of mixed emotions today about our fellowship and recovery. And on the one hand, I am more excited about my recovery today than I've ever been in my life. And for those of you that are mathematically challenged, when I give my sobriety date, I have 20 years. And it just keeps getting better. On the other hand, I go to meetings and, God, I see so much unnecessary suffering that, you know, it's kind of like lapse, relapse, repeat, repeat. And, you know, it doesn't have to be that way, that we are given the way out. And, you know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. The white book, this is my white book, I've kind of disguised it, but the white book is changed my life. There is so much great stuff in the white book. But this is graduate material. You know, this is master level material. You can read it, but you're not going to really understand it until you understand what's in the big book and the 12 and 12. You know, what's in the white book constantly references what is in these two books. And, you know, one of the things that the big book says in the preface is, because this book became the basic text of our society and has helped such large numbers of alcoholic men and women to recovery, there exists a sentiment against any radical changes being made in it. Therefore, the first portion of this volume describing the AA recovery program has been left untouched in the course of revisions made for both the second and third editions. The section called The Doctor's Opinion has been kept intact, just as it was originally written in 1939 by the late Dr. William D. Silkworth, our society's great medical benefactor. Now, a textbook, you know, when we're all familiar with textbooks, most of us didn't like them in school, but, you know, we know what they are. And a textbook is used to communicate information and meaning from the mind of one human being to another. Now, the program that is written in this book works. It has a better than 75% recovery rate. I don't think we have anything near that in the fellowships today. And when I say fellowships, in my AA home group last year, our area representative came back and told us that as of last year, Alcoholics Anonymous had licensed more than 300 organizations to use the 12 steps. Think about that a minute. 300 organizations have been able to use this program of recovery successfully to treat whatever kind of problem they got. OA, EA, DA, GA, NA, you know, it just goes on. Now, this is an interpretation of what is in this. And what I would suggest is that you never let anybody interpret for you the basic text. Now, you can get familiar with the basic text, and then this is going to make incredibly more sense. And this interpretation is divine. But you're not going to understand this until you understand this. You know, the 12 steps, you know, as it, there's the big book, the white book, the 12 and 12. This book was written in 1939, and there were growing pains. You know, as people read that big book and interpreted it, they found that there were problems, and the problems were many, and it had to do with, you know, how we interact with each other as human beings. How do we practice the spiritual principles? That it says in the big book that the program was derived mainly from science and religion. And, you know, I read just a second ago about the medical view. If anybody's interested, 2 years ago in Nashville, we had a medical doctor. It was the first time I'd ever heard a non-sexaholic address the fellowship. Burns Brady gave a two-hour talk on the doctor's opinion as it's written in the big book. But more than that, he talked about the 75 years of intervening science that has been done that confirms what they were talking about 75 years ago. And he talked about, you know, the advancements in technology with electroencephalographic tomography, you know, the functional MRIs where you can watch the brain light up and how it works and all. And if anybody's interested, you can email me and I would be happy to send you a link where you can download and listen to that. My email address is for robert2c@gmail.com. The number four, Robert, the number two, the letter C, for robert2c@gmail.com. I'd be happy to send you a link. Great stuff. That's kind of on the science end. On the religious end, you know, the program evolved out of the Oxford groups. That the Oxford groups were like 1840 to 1860 up to around the 1900 turn of the century. The Oxford groups were about 1880, 1890 up to around 1940. And Bill and Bob, when they got together, were both members of Oxford groups. When Bill, who was a periodic alcoholic, would go out on these benders and it'd get physically challenged, it'd drop 40 pounds and be experiencing DTs, and his brother-in-law was a medical doctor and they'd put him in the town's hospital for treatment. Well, their treatment at that time was drying him out and getting him in a physically stable condition, getting him back on solid food, and then tell him, you know, don't do this anymore. Very effective. Silkworth, the doctor there, was an epidemiologist. And CDC has tons of epidemiologists, and they kind of track the nature and patterns of diseases. Silkworth, his life career was not about, his life choice was not about working with alcoholics. He didn't particularly like alcoholics when he first started. But it was during the Depression, and he couldn't get a job anywhere else. So he went to work at Towns, and he's looking at all these alcoholics, and he says, you know, it appears to me that you guys have an allergy. You know, that you seem to be fairly intelligent and personable, nice people until you drink, and then you get kind of goofy. And you know, an allergy is nothing more than an abnormal reaction. You know, if you're allergic to bee stings, you get stung, you know, blow up. If you're allergic to strawberries and you eat strawberries, you break out in hives. If you're allergic to grasses, one thing or another, and have hay fever, you get watery eyes, runny nose, and stuff. For the alcoholic, and I also think the sexaholic, the symptom of the allergy is craving. That we want more. You know, the first time I take that lust hit, my immediate response is to want the second. You know, I want to build it and develop a story and a fantasy and everything. And then the obsession kicks in. And it's like, okay, you know, how do I get the time to set aside to act out? Who am I going to act out with? Do I need money? You know, and I start obsessing about how I'm going to make this thing happen. Well, Silkworth said, you know, don't take the first drink. You won't get drunk, you know. But that in and of itself is not enough. I mean, Bill relapsed three times out of Towns Hospital. And he had relapsed his last time, and his old running buddy, Ebby, called him up and said he wanted to come over, and Bill said, yeah, come on over, you know, and we'll have some booze. And Ebby showed up, and Bill knew that Ebby was supposed to be committed involuntarily for alcoholic insanity a couple months earlier, and Ebby shows up looking better than Bill's seen him in years, and had this glow about him. And, you know, what's going on, Eb? And sit down and have a drink. Eb says, no, I ain't drinking. And Bill says, why not? And he says, well, I found religion. And Bill says, ah, crap, you know. my gin will last longer than his preaching. Have a seat. But what Ebby did is he told him a story. And he told him the story of the Oxford groups. Now, the Oxford groups had actually evolved out of the first century Christian fellowship, which was like 1840, 1860, up until the turn of the century. Now, the first century Christian fellowship, you know, it was Bible-reading, church-going people that were reading their scripture, and they're seeing that the apostles were performing all these miracles, and they looked around and they said, well, where's the miracle workers? How come we don't see today what those early Christians were doing? And so they started studying what those first century Christians were doing, and they figured that studying those guys, there would be less garbling of the message over time, and they'd be closer to that original message. And the three basic tenets of the first century Christian fellowship were confession, restitution, and service. Confession, step 5, restitution, 9, and service 12. And where I got this information, if you read like AA Comes of Age and Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers and Bill's Passing On and stuff, it's all there. And what they would do is they would get together at somebody's house midweek, and they would lead with their weakness, confession, you know, and they would state, you know, my name is Frank, and I'm a rageaholic. Of course, he wouldn't say he's a rageaholic, but he'd say, I got a problem with my temper. You know, I got a real short temper, a real short fuse. It's small town, Midwest America, 1880. There's no unemployment. There's no welfare. You know, the boss said something pissed me off. I knocked him in the mouth and fired me on the spot. I've been blacklisted. I haven't worked in 6 weeks. There's no money. My kids are hungry. The landlord's going to evict us. My life is in the pits because of this character defect of mine. And Phyllis would say, you know, I'm a glutton. You know, I weigh 400 pounds. And my eating is such that, you know, my life is a mess. My family won't talk to me. They've disowned me. I'm a baker by trade. You know, my cousin's niece asked me to bake the cake, the wedding cake. And like the night before the wedding, I don't know, I ate the second layer. The reception was ruined. It cast a pall over the whole wedding. Nobody will talk to me. I mean, my life is the pits because of my character defect, my gluttony. And Bill would raise his hand and say, my name's Bill, and I'm an alcoholic. My name's Robert, and I'm a sexaholic. You ever wonder where that comes from? And one of my, you know, I'm reminded that a fanatic is someone that redoubles their effort after they've lost sight of the goal. And, you know, initially when people would come over the house, you know, somebody comes over to my house and we're going to have a meeting and say, you know, my name is Robert and I'm a sexaholic. I only got to say that once. You know, about the 10th time when he's sitting in the living room, it's like, my name is Robert and I'm a sexaholic. It's like, I'm not stupid. You know, how many times are you going to have to tell me this? Confession, anyway. Confession is leading with our weakness, transparency. And restitution is the restoring of the broken relationship. You know, the truth is that we're spiritual beings living in a spiritual universe, governed by spiritual laws, having a human experience. And that if we saw things the way that God sees things, there would be harmony in the universe. And my problem is that I show up with this little bit of God stuff bouncing into other people, with my selfishness, self-centeredness, and other character defects, and I leave this wake of emotional trauma. You know, people hear my name, they want to spit and curse. And what I've done is I've issued them an invitation to show up as their worst self, you know, to desire revenge and retaliation. And I don't think that that's how God wants things to be. You know, what I need to do is try and restore that broken relationship, at least to the point of neutrality that I had before I showed up with my stinking thinking, rotten attitude, and bad behavior. And then service to God and our fellows. Well, part of the service was witnessing. And part of their program of spiritual action was to go witness to one another. So Frank had to go find people with short tempers, and Phyllis had to go find gluttons, and Ebby had to go find Bill. Now, as Bill's working with these concepts, you know, he also recognizes that the alcoholics of the day, you know, because of their chemical abuse, their drug abuse, you know, had damaged brains. And so he kind of filled in some additional steps so that the alcoholic couldn't kind of wiggle out in the cracks. Step one is about powerlessness and unmanageability. It's about the recognition of the disease. And apparently Bill Wilson, for the first time in human history, you know, Silkworth gave him the solution, the medical solution. You have an allergy. Don't take the first drink. You won't get drunk. It's a physical allergy coupled with a mental obsession. And Ebby gave him the spiritual program of action that would enable him to find that spiritual, moral ease that allow him to not take that first drink. Step two is there is a way out. You know, we don't have to live in that condemned state of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. There is a way out. Step three is do it his way. Step three for me is real easy. You know, step three, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, as I understand it. It's I will or I won't. I will do it his way or I won't. And the only place that I have ever found God in any real or meaningful way is by taking the actions of this program of spiritual recovery that's contained in the Big Book and the 12 and 12. You know, four is a moral inventory. Five is that confession. Six is willingness. You know, three out of the 12 steps have to do with willingness. Willingness must be a big part of the program. I will or I won't. You know, and so anyway, I went over to Mike's house, and I asked this guy to be my sponsor. And I meant to bring the pamphlet, Questions and Answers on Sponsorship, but Mike had a couple of those. And we sat down and went through the first part of that. The pamphlet's in, today it's in four sections, then it was only three. But the first part is for the person looking for a sponsor, that'd be me. And then there's another portion for the person that wants to be a sponsor. Then there was a little section in the back on for groups that want to engage in sponsorship activity. Now there's also a section back there on service sponsors. But as we started going through the first part of that pamphlet, you know, Mike asked me, you know, he pointed out that it said that AA began with sponsorship, you know, with Bill and Bob, and Bill carried the message to Bob. And what was the message? You know, the message is what I just told you. You know, it was Silkworth's medical assessment of the condition of the disease, and it was Ebby's spiritual therapy, you know, via the First Century Christian Fellowship and the Oxford groups. Now, the Oxford groups had the four absolutes, and the four absolutes were absolute honesty, absolute unselfishness, absolute love, and absolute purity. You know, and Mike asked me, you know, what's the difference between truth and honesty? And today I understand that truth is that which does not change. Truth is that which does not change. And honesty has to do with the intent to deceive, or the lack of it. And what we have is a program of rigorous honesty. And the examples that I was given is, you know, 500 years ago, I could look you right in the eye and tell you in complete honesty, thank you, that you didn't want to sail too far in that direction because you'd sail right off the edge of the earth and the dragons would get you. It had nothing to do with the truth, but it was what people believed. And then 200 years after that, they knew that was a bunch of hooey. You know, the earth is round. And also that the earth is the center of the universe. And the sun and the moon and the stars all revolve around the planet Earth, and I can prove it to you because you can watch the sun come up over there and traverse the sky and set over there. Had nothing to do with the truth. I think that we have a program of rigorous honesty, and what we're trying to do is discover the truth of our beings. I believe that the truth of our being is that we're spiritual beings living in a spiritual universe governed by spiritual laws, having a human experience. You know, and absolute unselfishness. You know, and I often hear people say that this is a selfish program, and I think, no, 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 absolutely not. Selfishness is getting ahead at the expense of someone else. This is a program of enlightened self-interest. Enlightened self-interest blesses everyone. This is not a selfish program. It's about enlightened self-interest, and it's about carrying a message, about witnessing to each other, about being transparent. You know, I loved listening to Gayla in her talk. You know, it makes me want to be a better husband, a better spouse, a better partner to my wife. That transparency, that confession, that honesty. I mean, that's what I want, and that's why I think we're all here. You know, unselfishness, absolute love. And I didn't know what love was when I got here. I'm still confused quite a bit. And, I heard somebody say the other day, quoting Warren Buffett, you know, if you're not confused, you don't know what's going on. Today I understand that love is the desire to do good for another. Best definition I've come across. Love is the desire to do good for another. And one of the reasons I love that is because then I can love my enemies. You know, I can wish that God be in their life as God would be in their life. And if God's in their life the way that God would be in their life, I'm not going to have a problem with it. And then purity, absolute purity. And they talked about sexual purity. And we don't talk a lot about purity today. But I think much more than that, it not only did it encompass the sexual purity, but I think today we have a tendency, we would categorize it as integrity. And integrity is when I integrate my values into my behavior, not only my physical behavior, but my mental behavior. And I think that the third step says it very well in the 12 and 12 when it says that, you know, our whole problem had been the misuse of willpower. We had tried to bombard our problems with it instead of trying to bring it into alignment with God's will for us. To make this, the bringing of my will into alignment with God's will for me, to make this increasingly possible is the purpose of AA's 12 steps. And step three opens the door. Absolute honesty, unselfishness, love, purity. And these are the guiding principles that are in our fellowship. Now, the problem that I see today, well-meaning as it is so many people say, you know, well, my sponsor told me this or my sponsor told me that. And I think, man, that's not your sponsor. That's not what a sponsor is. What you're talking about is an unlicensed amateur therapist. Sponsorship is applying the principles that are in the steps. And as we say in Georgia, it ain't rocket science. I know, I sponsor a couple rocket scientists. They told me that ain't it. I work through the steps a step a week with Mike. And he told me to come over to his house and bring my big book and my 12 and 12, and we would see what the program of recovery as it's outlined in our literature is. And what the big book says is that of those early people that came, of those early 100, thank you, she's telling me you're almost done. Aren't you glad? that of those early people that came in, half of them came and got sober. And half relapsed. Relapse seems to be a condition in the fellowship. However, of the people that relapsed, half of those came back and got sober. And of the remainder, those that came back made progress. That's better than a 75% recovery rate. if we follow the program as it's written. I've been sponsoring guys a step a week like this. I mean, when I got done with Mike, he said, you know, service is not an option. There's 12 steps. And if we stay sober on 11, there'd only be 11. If we could stay sober on 5, there'd only be 5. We're addicts. You know, we're not going to work one more step than the absolute minimum that it takes to stay sober. Service is not an option. You know, I suggest that you, you know, go find someone to work with. Service has, it comes in two forms. There's the face-to-face that you do in carrying the message, and then there's the service that you do for your group. Because if the group doesn't make it, neither will you. This disease picks off the loners and the stragglers. You know, it's what are you doing for your group? Find something, you know, in the group to do, you know, whether it's literature person or chairman or, you know, in my case, chairman was I got to set up the chairs. you know, or inner group or the service structure, you know, just work your way. Do something, Robert. Do it all. Find something you like. Don't do it all at once. And that's what you do for your group. And then there's the face-to-face, you know, to carry the message, to work with the still suffering. That's our primary purpose. Our primary purpose is to carry that message. You know, confession, restitution, and service. And if you don't do service, you ain't going to make it. You ain't going to get it. I tell guys that I sponsor, you know, if you're not carrying the message, we're going to change our relationship. You're fired. Because you ain't going to make it. You're just a pain in my heart waiting to happen. And my heart's got enough scars on it, I don't need any more. You know, you're either willing to go to any length or you're not. And that's something that Mike asked me, you know, right at the beginning. After we got done working through that program, he asked me this question. He said, Robert, are you willing to go to any length to have a spiritual experience sufficient to bring about recovery from your disease? And I said, yeah. When I got done working the steps, he said, carry the message. Go find someone to work with. Go find someone sicker than you are. I know that's going to be tough for you, Robert. But if you try real hard, you'll find someone. And I've been doing it that way ever since. Now, fast forward another 4 years, and I finally got in touch with my sexaholism and got into sexual recovery. And when I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, it was like somebody turned on a giant spotlight that was spirituality. And when I got sexually sober, it became a laser. And in living this program and practicing these principles on a daily basis to the best of my ability, as it's written in our program, in our literature, I have harmony in my life. I have peace, serenity, wisdom beyond my ability, strength, understanding, compassion, tolerance, pity, you know, things of which I had little clue. And I find that when I get out of sync with my steps, when my program starts to fall down, and usually that comes when my meeting attendance falls off, or if I'm not working with sponsees, you know, I just start getting a lot more discord. You know, I find myself wanting to flip people off on the freeway. I haven't flipped them off in a long time. Or getting into arguments on people with some bureaucrat on the phone, or, you know, getting crosswise with people. And when I'm practicing my program, I have a lot more harmony. And I want to live in that harmony. That's where I want to live today. And I'm going to close with this. Two things. Three. Bill Wilson wrote in the pamphlet, Questions Other Than Alcohol, that the sole purpose of an AA meeting is sobriety from alcohol through the teaching and practice of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think SA would be well served to adopt that same guiding attitude. The sole purpose of an SA meeting is sobriety from lust through the practice and teaching of the 12 steps of Sexaholics Anonymous. The group's primary purpose is to carry the message to the still suffering sexaholic. I think we need to do more in public information, cooperation with the professional community to get the name out there. We are not a secret society. We do have a program, a policy of public relations. It's not that we don't have the policy. Anonymity is different than confidentiality. I'll save that for a different talk. And lastly, as we work through the steps and we become transformed, we find that what the literature says is our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and our fellows. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and our fellows. And I'm going to close with something out of the big book, and it's in Dr. Bob's Nightmare. And he says, "It is a most wonderful blessing to be relieved of the terrible curse with which I was afflicted. My health is good, and I have regained the respect, my self-respect and the respect of my colleagues. My home life is ideal, and my business is as good as can be expected in these uncertain times. I spend a great deal of time passing on what I learned to others who want it and need it badly, and I do it for four reasons. A sense of duty. It is a pleasure, because in so doing, I am paying my debt to the man who took the time to pass it on to me. And lastly, because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. I'd like to thank you for all for having me here today."